Now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Well, last week we thought about the first of these phrases in our creed, God above us. And you may remember that one of the things I tried to say about that phrase, we believe in God above us, maker of heaven and earth, sun and moon and earth and water and so on, was that there is a kind of, there's a beautiful humility which is sometimes missing from modern secular culture. There's a beautiful humility which, of course, this recognition of God above us also shares with many other faiths. A humility that says, we are not the final sum and circuit of all truth, knowledge, being, and goodness. There is always that beyond and above us. We didn't make this astonishing cosmos in which we find ourselves. We didn't even make ourselves. We find ourselves in the midst of what the poet Philip Larkin called the million-petaled flower of being here. And it's an act of joyful humility to look out in awe at the perhaps unknowable, unimaginable, beautifully transcendent one from whom these things flow. That's a profound and essential impulse of the heart and, if you like, the beginning of joyful worship. And the metaphor that expresses much of that sense of the enormity and beauty and astonishing sort of transcendence of God is the metaphor of upness or height. So we celebrated that. But you may remember that towards the end of that sermon, I said there is a danger if we are to think of God as only God above us. Because just as height can symbol the transcendent, the beautiful, the clear, the holy, that point from which there is an all-inclusive perspective, height and aboveness can also seem to symbolize for many people and can be made in dreadful parodies of good religion, can be made to symbolize something or someone lofty, remote, overshadowing, domineering, hurling thunderbolts down from above, as it were. And there is a false side of aboveness. We need something, as it were, to complement and work with the aboveness. So our creed goes on, having affirmed, yes, we believe in God above us, to say, yes, we also believe in God beside us. And it's holding these together. It's the dynamic between the aboveness and the besideness, and as we'll soon see, the withinness, that actually makes for the kind of transforming energy and vision of faith. So we believe, we are going to say in our creed, we believe in God beside us, Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh, born of a woman's womb, servant of the poor. And this is the core and the heart of the gospel, the good news, the revelation that God has indeed come to be Emmanuel, God with us, to be Jesus Christ, God beside us, to be in our midst. And in this, he fulfills a promise. We heard of that extraordinary encounter with Moses at the burning bush. And again, Moses, you know, having made an attempt to sort things out for his fellow Israelites in Egypt and having made a complete failure of it, and he's killed somebody in an attempt to stop an injustice, but he didn't start a revolution. All he ended up was running away as a wanted man, and you know, the final humiliation of working for his father-in-law. And so he's kind of on what would have been for Moses the equivalent of the daily commute. You know, this was just where he ran the sheep on Mount Horeb, big deal. You've seen one scrubby little bush, you've seen them all. And suddenly, in the midst of that utter ordinariness, something extraordinary flows out towards him, and he finds himself standing in the presence of the living God. He finds that there is holy ground. Now, that is extraordinary in itself, that the transcendent and utterly above God should suddenly blaze not down onto, but out of the bush. But then, listen to the great things that God says to Moses. He says, I have seen the suffering. I have heard the cries. I know the affliction. And then, I have come down. Or in some translations, I will come down. Or I am coming down. And we might see the first hint of the coming down there. But for Moses, although there's this brief glimpse of the bush, and many Christian commentators have said, oh, what a beautiful foreshadowing of the incarnation. You see, the bush was not consumed. You see, the nature of God was fully within it, and yet the bush remained entirely unviolated in its nice green bushiness, as it were. It was not consumed by the fire. It had both. And people have rightly, I think, seen that as a foreshadowing of how the divine nature would come in the end to shine not out of the leaves of a bush, but to shine onto us the great yes of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So we can see something beginning there. But still with Moses, there is that sense primarily of what we might call the vertical axis. And that's emphasized very strongly when Moses goes up the mountain to meet with God and is afraid to meet with God and can only look, as it were, at God's back with his face turned away. And you may remember that when Moses goes up the mountain to talk with God, there's a point in one of the narratives where he says to everybody else, well, aren't you coming up with me? And they all go, bit busy this evening. I think serious encounters with the Holy, if you'd like to do that for us, that would be wonderful. We'll just stay down here and, make a few calves in your absence. You do it for us. And there's always that sense, I think, in humanity that because God is awesome and holy, and because we feel unprepared, and because we tend to shield ourselves from anything too intense, we'd rather somebody else did that. So although there is promise and joy, there is also, if you like, a proper fearfulness, an alarm in the promise. I have come down. I'm coming down. I'm not going to keep my distance. You're too precious to me. You matter too much to me for me to deal with you de haut en bas from a distance. I'm going to get alongside. And of course, that comes astonishingly true in the gospel. And John, we saw there, drew that contrast. The law came through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So in and through Jesus Christ, God comes to be not only God above us, but God beside us. But what does beside us mean? Is he only just God beside us for that brief period of 30 years in Palestine 2,000 years ago when he was walking the earth in a mortal body like ours, living and breathing with hands and eyes and beating heart? Was it a temporary episode of besideness, followed by a return to exclusive aboveness? No. Emphatically, no. That's part of the meaning of Easter and the resurrection of body, and it's the whole of the meaning of the mystery of this sacrament, in which his body is presented to you. He is beside us always. He came to be beside us as long as we need him beside us. And the more we know ourselves, the more we know that we need him beside us. He is beside us always, but he is especially close and beside us in our pain, in our hurts, when we ourselves are beginning to walk our own Via Dolorosa. That is when we find him beside us, and that, of course, is why he chose to walk his. To be truly God with us, God beside us, he has to dare, in a fully human as well as a fully divine way, to go into whatever darkness, to go down with us into whatever pit that we find ourselves in. And that includes, ultimately, the valley of the shadow of death and death itself. And even that was foreshadowed and promised that he would do that when David, the shepherd boy, had that moment of extraordinary insight and said, the Lord is my shepherd. And though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, beside me. Thy rod and thy staff comfort me. How can it be that this moment that we see of him beside us on the Via Dolorosa, him with his arms out on the cross, can be, as it were, right through time, even for us, even though at one level it seemed to happen just for 30 years. There's a wonderful image which I have just personally found very helpful, which comes towards the end of a wonderful novel by Helen Waddell about the theologian Peter Abelard, and which is a novel exploring the problem of suffering and the nature of atonement. And it's a wonderful, wonderful novel. But there's an extraordinary passage just to the end when Abelard, who has endured this extraordinary suffering, has been separated from Eloise, has been castrated, has been defrocked, has been forced into a kind of exile beyond the church as the punishment for his love, and is with a little, well, with a disciple, one or two other people that have followed him in, living a hermit's life in the woods. And having, you know, been through so much, they're out trying to find peace in these woods, and they hear screaming. And what it turns out when they go out, responding just in a human way to this cry of pain, turns out to be an animal, it turns out to be a rabbit that's been caught in a snare, crying out. And they take it out of the snare, and it's dying in Abelard's arms. And suddenly, Thibaut, one of Abelard's disciples, makes this extraordinary remark about, because they're all saying, does God see this? How can God stand this? Where is God when this is happening? And the disciple says to Abelard, perhaps the agony of Christ on the cross is like this. And he points to a fallen tree trunk where there's been a tree felled, and you can see, as it were, the rings. He says, we see that dark core just sliced out like that. We can see it. But actually, although we see it on one plane because it's been opened up to us, that particular dark core runs all the way up through the tree, up to its branches and all the way down through the roots. But we, in cutting it, have just seen it. And he said, maybe that's what we saw on the cross. We saw, as it were, shown to us openly in time, the way God enters into the heart of everything and suffers in and through and with everything, as it were. That pattern of God's complete entering into our hurt is like, well, to perhaps a less sublime image, it's like the kind of writing through the piece of rock. It's going on there. Wherever you slice into time, at whatever moment, there he is, still there for you. So although we don't experience his physical besideness in exactly the same way that the thief on the cross did, who literally did indeed, he didn't just have to say, I believe in God beside us. He was speaking to God beside him. And he said that beautiful prayer, which is really all you need to say, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Though we may not have him beside us in the same way that the thief did, outwardly and visibly, we do, I believe, absolutely, truly, and indeed I would say physically, have him with us. How is that? How is he beside us now if he's not hanging beside us as he did beside the thief on the cross? Well, he comes to be beside us in an extraordinary number of ways, but certainly, absolutely dependably, by means of his steadfast covenant love, he has promised without fail to be with us and to be beside us this evening when we hold out our hands and receive him, body and blood, in bread and wine. That is the most beautiful, the most steadfast, the most reliable way, it seems to me, that we can know that God is indeed beside us, and more than beside us, because he comes even through the bread and wine, also as the bread and wine goes within us, to be God within us. And we're going to reflect a little bit next week on what that might mean. But thanks be to God that particularly on our darker roads and in our harder times, He is indeed God beside us. Amen.